We are approaching one of the biggest decisions this country will face in our lifetimes, whether to remain in a reformed European Union or to leave. The choice goes to the heart of the kind of country we want to be and the future that we want for our children. This is about how we trade with neighboring countries to create jobs, prosperity, and financial security for our families. And it's about how we cooperate to keep our people safe and our country strong. I know there will be many passionate arguments over the months ahead, and individual cabinet ministers will have the freedom to campaign in a personal capacity as they wish. But my responsibility as Prime Minister is to speak plainly about what I believe is right for our country. I do not love Brussels, I love Britain. I'm the first to say that there are still many ways in which Europe needs to improve, and that the task of reforming Europe does not end with yesterday's agreement. And I will never say that our country couldn't survive outside Europe. We are Great Britain. We can achieve great things. That is not the question in this referendum. The question is, will we be safer, stronger, and better off working together in a reformed Europe or out on our own? I believe we'll be safer in a reformed Europe because we can work with our European partners to fight cross-border crime and terrorism. I believe Britain will be stronger in a reformed Europe because we can play a leading role in one of the world's largest organizations from within, helping to make the big decisions on trade and security that determine our future. And I believe we'll be better off in a reformed Europe, because British businesses will have full access to the free trade single market, bringing jobs, investment, and lower prices. Let me be clear, leaving Europe would threaten our economic and our national security. Those who want to leave Europe cannot tell you if British businesses would be able to access Europe's free trade single market, or if working people's jobs are safe, or how much prices would rise. All they're offering is a risk at a time of uncertainty, a leap in the dark. Our plan for Europe gives us the best of both worlds. It underlines our special status, through which families across Britain get all the benefits of being in the European Union, including more jobs, lower prices, and greater security. But our special status also means we're out of those parts of Europe that do not work for us. So we will never join the euro, we will never be part of eurozone bailouts, never be part of the passport-free, no borders area, or a European army, or an EU superstate. 3 years ago, I committed to the British people that I would renegotiate our position in the European Union and hold an in-out referendum. Now I am delivering on that commitment. You will decide, and whatever your decision, I will do my best to deliver it. On Monday, I will commence the process set out under our Referendum Act, and I will go to Parliament and propose that the British people decide our future in Europe through an in-out referendum on Thursday, the 23rd of June. The choice is in your hands. But my recommendation is clear. I believe that Britain will be safer, stronger, and better off in a reformed European Union.
Brexit. Upon discussing with collaborators and friends about the making of this episode, I was met with a chorus of very similar responses. Are you mad? Oh, I'm sick of hearing about bloody Brexit. Or a sarcastic, good luck with that one. general consensus seemed to be that to tackle this subject would result in strong criticism, bringing negative attention to myself and the podcast, or worse still, attract threats or heated rhetoric. I think it's safe to say that in the 3 years since the referendum, the public vote on whether the United Kingdom should remain a member state of the European Union, the countries of England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland have become divided nations. Not split in terms of borders, well, not yet at least, but split in regards to political opinion. For fierce opinions have developed, split in friend groups, families, and workplaces across the national spectrum. The rise of far-right and far-left opinions have grown in extremism, and the country has become a fiery political melting pot. Now, I don't intend on delving too deep into political jargon, law, and procedure during this episode, nor do I intend to plunge to depths of party politics, state regulation and procedure, or government affairs that will send those outside the UK civil service to sleep. I don't have to. The truth about Brexit is simpler than that. It's not deep or drenched in secrecy. I intend to talk about what's hidden in plain sight. What is there for all to see and understand because the evidence is freely available. In fact, this episode only took 3 days to write and record, far less time than my average episode. And that's because the evidence was copious, easily accessible, and ubiquitous, should you wish to look for the facts yourself, of course. I think I should clarify at this juncture too that I don't have any political leanings or strong opinion on Brexit. I do not vote, mainly because I don't see anyone who is worth voting for, who can be honest, who I have confidence in, or who has an untarnished political record. I say this in terms of politicians or political parties, of course. I have a great deal of derision for all political parties in the United Kingdom, and I'd like to make that clear from the start, so that it is also clear that I have no agenda in the making of this podcast episode other than sharing the facts and evidence of Brexit. So with that said, I could not with clear conscience vote towards putting any of the United Kingdom's political parties in a position of power, nor could I trust any of them to always do the right thing by the populace. Like many Western nations, the political leaders in the UK are too intertwined with corporations, lobbyists, big business, and the wealthy elite, which will always have raised the question as to where their influence comes from and where their interests lie. Personally, I don't see how the two can work harmoniously together. For if a public servant, and take a note of that title, is paid more by wealthy influencers than by which they are provided for their service to the nation, then is it unreasonable to assume that those they take better care of are not the lowest bidder? I guess it bears the question that why, in an advanced, wealthy and moral nation, do we not have laws that prevent those who hold public office from receiving monetary reward or donation from any other source other than the people? I guess that's kind of rhetorical, really, as you and I both know who makes those laws. Political parties and government bodies aside, I also did not vote in the Brexit referendum. I was out of the country at the time. Do I have an opinion on it? Sure I do. But now that the vote has happened and a clear outcome has been declared, I simply believe that the outcome should be obeyed as we are a democratic nation. However, like millions of my countrymen, whilst I respect the outcome of the vote, I can also see clearly what it will lead to for this country and what it will mean for millions of people and businesses, and I am extremely worried for the future of the United Kingdom. But what I'm going to do tonight is look at how the hell we got into this mess in the first place, why we got into this mess, and the great big lie the British government are telling the people, knowingly, without a care, and with only their own self-interests at heart. And what's more, I'm going to provide you with the evidence to prove it. Brexit is current, massive, and a conspiracy and criminal act that will change the face of the United Kingdom forever. The perpetrators of the destruction have made you believe that you want it, and further, they will make the masses push them to seal their own fate. such is the level and entrenchment of the deception. This is a special Dead Soul Social Club report on the Great Brexit Lie. Back in 2016, in the months leading up to the June 23rd referendum, politicians, business leaders, those of influence, and members of the public campaigned. Those who wanted to leave the European Union, and those who wanted to remain a part of it. Those who wanted to remain gave their commitment to a Europe stronger together. Stronger by being united on defence, a single economic market which meant cheaper goods for everyone and tariff-free membership to the world's largest trading bloc. Obstacle-free trading with a union that accounts for 50% of the UK import and exports. Retention of £1.2 trillion worth of EU foreign investment, or 47% of the UK's foreign investment. Investment from the European Social Fund. Protection for consumers by EU competition. Tax and monopoly laws. Human rights for all UK nationals. Insurance under European law that the death penalty cannot be reintroduced in the UK. Freedom of movement and work across of European countries. EU food, climate, air, farming and land standards. Healthcare, science, university, energy and defence funding and research contributions. Employment rights. Sexual orientation rights. Religious rights. Freedom rights. Guaranteed special status for the UK, for Northern Ireland and Gibraltar. And those are just amongst a multitude of other things. Those who voted to leave the European Union give the following reasons in the media and as part of the Leave campaign. That the European Union threatened British sovereignty. That the European Union was run by unelected diplomats, therefore is undemocratic. The UK will have the freedom to agree their own trade deals outside of the EU, thus making it financially better off as the EU holds the UK back. The UK will be able to control its own borders and control immigration, as under EU law it has zero control of both. That the UK sends £350 million per week to the EU, and if we leave, we can use that money elsewhere, like the NHS, for example. Also, the UK would be able to set its own laws, which was a power taken away from the UK under EU membership. While these were the key campaign points, other claims were thrown into the mix, such as Turkey was on the verge of becoming an EU member state, and if that happened, millions of Turkish nationals would flood the UK. A claim aimed at the far right, no doubt. And also, if the UK remain in the EU, we will eventually be forced to join the euro currency and also the United European Army, thus ending the United Kingdom as an independent nation. So let's analyse those facts, impartially, based solely on freely available evidence. Firstly, every single point that the Remain campaign has used as reasons why the UK should remain in the EU, as I just outlined, are all true. They are all benefits the United Kingdom already enjoys as being part of the European Union. That cannot be debated and is fact. It's in stone and undeniable. Secondly, every single point that the Leave campaign has used as reasons why the UK should leave the membership of the European Union, and just to clarify, that's all of the points I just mentioned, well, they are all false. All of them. Either misinformation or grossly incorrect claims from the Vote Leave camp. Whether the Vote Leave campaigners' claims were intentional or made through naive oversight, I'll let you decide. But they are categorically and provably incorrect. And here is why Vote Leave's reasons to leave the EU were incorrect and misleading. Published in 2016, the UK government's outline for leaving the European Union states thus: Parliament has remained sovereign throughout our membership of the EU. The European Union has never, in fact, had the authority or ability to force laws onto the United Kingdom, nor policies, protocols, or procedures. The United Kingdom has always had the right to decide whether it adopts any of the EU laws, procedures, and guidelines. Further, the United Kingdom has always been one of the strongest and most influential members of the European Union and is a key member in terms of shaping law, procedure, and policy. It has retained a veto power in the European Council and only adopted elements it wanted and rejected elements it did not want. Any law in the European Union is seen as being shaped and strongly influenced by the United Kingdom. This has been the case since the UK joined in 1973. In fact, the United Kingdom's legal system is seen by Europe as a system to be admired and integrated into the EU, not the other way around. The United Kingdom's justice system is one of the oldest and most admired in the world. This is a fact, and I urge you to speak to anyone in the legal profession, either inside or outside of the United Kingdom, and they will almost certainly agree. By leaving the European Union, the United Kingdom will not regain any element of sovereignty, as not a minute piece of sovereignty has ever left the ownership of the UK. In fact, the dictionary definition of sovereign is this: as having supreme or ultimate power. In modern democracies, the people's will is in fact sovereign. So by definition alone, if the UK had lost sovereignty to the EU, then it would not have even been able to vote to leave the European Union in the first place. It is the UK sovereignty that allows the British people to do so. So on to how the EU is run by unelected diplomats. Here's the truth behind that false claim. The EU is in fact run democratically by two specific bodies: the Council of the European Union. These are government ministers from each of the EU member states, which meet regularly, and the European Parliament. This is the General Assembly of 751 directly elected members of the European Parliament, which represent each of their constituencies. Those in Europe and the UK will remember voting for yours democratically only a few months ago. The European Commission, who are sort of a European civil service, much like the one we have here in the UK, also consists of 30,000 European civil servants who spend their time administering EU laws that have been voted for democratically by the member states, which includes the United Kingdom. The Commission is overseen by 28 commissioners. Each one of those are nominated by each member state's elected governments. The European Union has a European Union president. This is currently Jean-Claude Juncker. The post was founded in 1958. Each new president is nominated by the European Council, so the member states, and is formally elected for a 5-year term by the European Parliament. The president promotes and acts as the spokesperson on the international stage for the European Union, but does not have any power or control over individual states within the Union. As a member state, the United Kingdom votes on who holds this position, and remember, the UK has a veto power regarding all votes within the EU. The European Union is highly democratic and mirrors the level of democracy observed here in the United Kingdom. So, next up, the UK will have the freedom to agree their own trade deals, thus making it financially better off outside the EU, as the EU held the UK back. This claim has always stuck with me as being quite baffling, if not ridiculous, mainly because the European Union, being our closest neighbour, accounts for half of all of our trade. And by taking that away, we'll have a hugely negative impact on the country. More so, the European Union aren't going to want to incentivize country to leave the Union, as that's counterproductive for their interests. So in that case, any future deal or relationship with Europe will need to be, in their eyes, lesser than what the United Kingdom already has as part of the Union. That's not to punish us, but merely the EU looking after its own interests, as we would do in the same situation. So the UK, with its closest trading partner, can only realistically achieve less of a trade deal in the future, and who knows when or if that will even happen. Ironically, the UK will have to trade with other countries under World Trade Organization rules. the World Trade Organization, who are based in Switzerland, are an unelected bureaucratic organization for which we have no say, no votes, and no control over what they impose on the UK. To quote an article in The Economist on the 17th of January 2019, it seems ironic then that the UK is losing power, influence, and trade benefits in the name of taking back control. Quite so indeed. So let's not forget, as a member of the European Union, the United Kingdom has a strong say in trade deals that the EU countries have with other world nations. And don't forget that veto power. The United Kingdom negotiates as part of a 28-state power, which is a hugely strong position to be in, perhaps stronger than any other nation regarding negotiations. Now, the UK will have to negotiate any deals alone as a small island with significantly less power against other hugely powerful nations. With significantly less bargaining power in deals and with opposing countries likely wanting access to the NHS and the financial centre of the UK, the City of London, this will impact the United Kingdom hard. Two of our biggest assets, now up for grabs and looking likely to be stripped down, whereas it would have been protected as part of the European Union. It seems crazy, not to mention hugely risky. Actually, no. A risk implies something that may or may not happen. But other nations have already made comments about both, so an element of certainty presents itself here. May God help us, one UK politician stated. I concur. The UK will be able to control its own borders and control immigration, as under EU law it has zero control of both, the Vote Leave campaign declared. For me, this has always been a comment that made me feel uneasy, mainly as it had connotations of right-wing rumblings, and history has taught us lessons we all know about those. But anyway, two words for you. Schengen area. This is the borderless area within the EU that allows free movement unchecked at borders, etc. Well, the UK has never joined it. The UK opted out of joining the Schengen area to, and I quote, maintain control over its own borders. That was while being a member of the European Union. You see, in a democracy like the EU, each member state has the choice to democratically decide if something applies to their specific member state or not. The UK doesn't need to leave the EU to have control of its own borders. It already does and always has. UK immigration failings are due to the government of the United Kingdom and nothing to do with the EU. But what about Europeans who move to the UK? Well, UK law states that free movement grants visitors temporary residence only for up to 3 months, the same as anyone visiting the UK from any country in the world. Beyond that, a European visitor must meet specific criteria to be able to stay. Two items of that specific criteria being that they must be either in full-time education or full-time employment. What most don't realise, though, is that anyone staying in the UK as an immigrant, whether an EU citizen or international citizen, and whether working or studying, can only stay in the UK at the discretion and permission of Her Majesty's government. But get this, the United Kingdom does not have sufficient or methodical resources in place to check immigration statistics, nor to monitor those who overstay. And that is a problem and failing within the United Kingdom government, and them inadequately managing the immigration of the UK and nothing to do with the European Union. So for those who voted leave for reasons of immigration and not wanting those outsiders to be let in, you should point your frustration at the nation's government that you elected. The claim that the UK sends £350 million per week to the EU, and that if we leave the EU, we can use that money elsewhere, like the NHS, for example. Okay. Firstly, that figure is incorrect, as the UK receives a rebate from the EU which is equivalent to around £100 million per week if you want to look at it in basic terms. The £350 million quoted does not include that rebate. Also, the UK doesn't pay the EU a weekly fee. It's not that simple. The money the UK has invested into the European Union also generates trade, investment and business for the UK, which the country would not have without the EU investment. In 2017, for example, the UK received £4.9 billion from the EU, and that's not including the business and investment that the country saw from Europe, which is immeasurable. Nigel Farage, the now leader of the Brexit Party in the UK and former leader of the UK Independence Party, a party with far-right views, was, alongside the now UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, a firm and vocal campaigner for leaving the EU in the run-up to the referendum. The Vote Leave campaign emblazoned across their campaign bus that the UK sends £350 million per week to the EU, money we can spend on the NHS. Despite being told by the National Statistics Office several times that this was incorrect, they still advertised it. A poll by Ipsos Mori, published on the 16th of June 2016, found that nearly half of the British public believed that claim, even though the Leave campaign knew it was false. The morning the referendum result was announced, Nigel Farage on live television famously backtracked on the campaign promise. When asked if £350 million would now be spent on the NHS instead, he replied, "No, I can't guarantee it, and I would never have made that claim. That was one of the mistakes that I think the Leave campaign made," he said. He actually did make that claim on more than one occasion. So what about all those ludicrous laws imposed on the British by the dastardly Eurocrats? Simply put, they don't exist. The European Union does not have the power or authority to create laws and impose them on the nation of Great Britain. That's an undeniable fact. In fact, there is strong evidence that they were made up by British anti-EU journalists, and further, there is evidence that one of those journalists was now British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, while he worked in his previous career, of course, with the Times and the Daily Telegraph newspapers. Because between 1989 and 1994, Boris Johnson was a journalist who reported from the European Commission in Brussels. He quickly made a name for himself by portraying the European Commission as incompetent foreigners who were forcing their will on the great nation of Britain. It's no secret, in fact, it's well publicised even, that Boris Johnson's personal and political hero is Winston Churchill. Johnson is known to share Churchill's views on a British empire and an outdated view of the United Kingdom. Johnson found during this time creating questionable myths about the EU in the press that he won many friends amongst many old-fashioned Conservative Party members in the UK who would lap up every word that he wrote. Johnson was responsible for a style of fake news that became known as the Euromyth. Unchallenged, Johnson deliberately lied and scaremongered in almost all of his articles regarding the EU and Europe because there was such a lack of challenge or issue raised with his libelous comments. Simply put, people believed him. Thus, he continued the practice far into his political career, and to this day, some might say. So the claim that the UK will be economically better off outside the European Union. This claim, by Vote Leave, is particularly damaging to the British public because it will negatively impact the livelihood of millions of citizens. The UK currently enjoys all the benefits that go with being part of the world's most democratic trading union. That includes tariff-free import and export trade. Also, the EU's massive single market allows the EU to be an even contender against the world's other two economic superpowers, China and the United States, therefore leveling the playing fields in terms of fairness. The economic benefits of EU membership provide the UK, it is estimated by experts, with a return on investment of around 5 to 15 times the annual membership fee that the UK pays. By leaving the European Union, the United Kingdom will lose all of these economic advantages quite literally overnight. The British Treasury's expert analysis of the effects of Brexit are that, no matter the style of Brexit and the type of deal that the UK agrees, be it a Norway-style, Canada-style, or a World Trade Organization rules, no-deal exit, the outcomes will all lead to the same result. There is no economic benefit to the United Kingdom. None. The UK will not be better off in any possible way by leaving the European Union. Her Majesty's Treasury published its official report into the impact of Brexit on April 18, 2016. To take a direct quote from that report, it states, "The Treasury's analysis shows that the UK would be permanently poorer if it left the EU and adopted any of these models. Productivity and GDP per person would be lower in all of these alternative scenarios, as the costs would substantially outweigh any potential benefit of leaving the EU." So unquestionably, British businesses will be negatively impacted. Advancement in UK science and research will be negatively impacted. British citizens will no longer have the right to work anywhere in Europe. UK students will no longer be able to work or study in the European Union. The UK's National Health Service will have fewer doctors and nurses. And also, financially poor areas in the country will lose EU investment grants. The International Monetary Fund also stated in its expert analysis that a no-deal Brexit would impact the United Kingdom to the cost of between 5 to 8% of its GDP. That directly equates to a loss of thousands of pounds for every UK household. Financial experts also warn that it is extremely likely that leaving the EU will trigger a recession in the UK, which could last years. The economic risks of Brexit will negatively impact UK families, businesses, jobs, living standards, and public finances for more than a generation, and that is unavoidable in any Brexit scenario. In August 2018, a leaked government plan for Brexit indicated it had increased spending on body bags, as the government is expecting the mortality rate to increase following Brexit. That again, the UK government have put plans in place to cope when the death rate will hugely increase as a direct result of Brexit. Oh, and they also kept that hidden from the general public too, by the way. So the reasons given by the Vote Leave campaign were bullshit. Further, millions of people believed said bullshit and voted accordingly based on that bullshit. But, while spreading lies and falsehoods is pretty dreadful and diabolical behaviour on the part of the Vote Leave campaign, of course, what's the bigger picture here? What's the conspiracy? And what are the government and UK elite keeping from the public? Why were those lies and falsehoods even peddled in the first place? Well, let's look at who gains from winning a Leave vote, and also what the EU stands for, because in identifying what the EU stands for will give you an indication of what those who are against it want. So, simply put, the European Union was set up with the aim of ending the frequent and bloody wars that were between European neighbours, which culminated in the Second World War. As of 1950, the European coal and steel community began to unite European countries economically and politically in order to secure lasting peace. According to the European Union's official website, the Union's purpose is to promote peace, establish a unified economic and monetary system, promote inclusion and combat discrimination, break down barriers to trade and borders, encourage technological and scientific developments, champion environmental protection, and, among others, promote goals like a competitive global market and social progress. The European Union is a coalition of 28 European countries, designed to tear down trade, economic and social barriers and promote flourishing in these areas. In creating a union, a united coalition for trade and defence formed, making Europe a stable and safe place to live for its citizens. safe in the knowledge that all 28 nations formed a solidarity with one another and protected each other in the event of foreign aggression. Further, the trade coalition it generated made all these countries of Europe a combined force that challenged the strongest economies in the world for a fairer slice of the world economic pie. Small countries within Europe could now hold a strong worldwide economic image that they would never be able to do so on their own as a small nation with limited resources. A combined economic trading stance enables even the smallest member to take a strong position on trading with the top worldwide economies. For those within the Union, it certainly seems like a pretty good deal, doesn't it? But who and why would be against what the EU stands for? Well, we've already established that those who voted to leave were fed lie after lie and a series of misinformation aimed at influencing their vote. So it's safe to say that someone had an agenda, someone who orchestrated the lies of the Vote Leave campaign, wanted the British electorate to leave a safe, secure and beneficial union under a shroud of misinformation that would make those who voted leave think they were voting for something that would leave them better off and in a stronger position. Many on the far right, not only in Europe, but also in the USA, Russia, and other parts of the world, have come to see disruption, disintegration, and destruction of the EU as highly desirable, if not essential. After all, the EU has brought decades of unprecedented multinational cooperation, peace, and social progress. For the far right, this is intolerable. The EU referendum was their moment to turn that tide, because the objective of the far right is purely nationalism, nativist, authoritarian, xenophobic, and anti-democratic. To close the borders, keep the outsiders out, and form a strong, united, nationalistic nation against the world by any means necessary. So despite being an American citizen, Trump's campaign leader Steve Bannon, for example, has been actively promoting far-right parties across Europe in recent years, including the UK's BNP, the EDL, UKIP, and anything to do with Nigel Farage. Bannon would like to see the EU torn down and be replaced by a Trump-style nationalistic nation and xenophobic outlook in country. Bannon is also the former vice president of Cambridge Analytica, the notorious digital persuasion company that was investigated by UK authorities and closed down in May 2018. Evidence was obtained to show that it has interfered in many elections around the world, such as Brexit and the 2016 US presidential election, through its data mining and behavioral research and influence operations. During the run-up to the EU referendum, the Facebook corporation enabled Cambridge Analytica to post blatant lies to UK citizens about the EU, as well as harvest data regarding millions of citizens. The purpose of these was to urge carefully selected, i.e. psychologically susceptible and impressionable, members of the British public to vote leave. So as I mentioned, the vice president of Cambridge Analytica was one Steve Bannon. He's the man who ran Donald Trump's 2016 presidential election campaign. The director of Cambridge Analytica was one Alexander Nix. Nix is a graduate of Eton College, the exclusive private school attended by all manner of senior British Conservative Party members of Parliament, such as Boris Johnson, for example. Nix at Cambridge Analytica also became an associate of one Aaron Banks, a wealthy British businessman and political donor who funded and founded the Vote Leave Brexit campaign. Further, Banks is an associate of Nigel Farage. Banks was investigated in November 2018 by the National Crime Agency for his involvement with Russian embassy officials in the run-up to the Brexit Leave campaign. And yet, despite all this, the referendum itself had no legal relevance, as the result was only an advisory referendum in the first place. It had no legal relevance, as the result was like an opinion poll, not mandatory, like a legal statute. something that is rarely mentioned. So even though the referendum campaign is now, in effect, just a massive crime scene subject to multiple criminal investigations, the result itself cannot be overturned on legal grounds because it has no legal status in the first place. Despite politicians repeatedly claiming that they've been given a clear mandate to leave the EU because the people have spoken, the government was, and still is, under no legal obligation whatsoever to act on the result. So why did they? Let's take a look at corporate tax avoidance. So, throughout the world, corporate tax avoidance is a colossal problem. And by far the biggest enabler of corporate tax avoidance, with its global network of secretive tax haven territories, is the United Kingdom. Britain has single-handedly done more to undermine the world's tax system than any other nation. Tax haven territories linked to Britain are responsible for around a third of the world's corporate tax avoidance risk, said journalist Ben Chapman in The Independent on the 28th of May 2019. So Britain itself is badly affected by unpaid corporate tax. Yet, the Conservative Party has done little to address the matter. This seems particularly galling when we consider that the amount of missing tax per year is about the same as the total reduction in welfare spending in the name of austerity, which is over £30 billion. In 2016, the EU published its planned Anti-Tax Avoidance Directive, which seeks to tackle the thriving culture of corporate tax avoidance. The directive came into effect in 2019. A continuation of membership of the EU, or even just the single market, means that the UK must adopt and enforce this anti-tax avoidance policy on itself. This obviously conflicts with all those major companies and businesses owners who dodge taxes, as well as numerous leaders of power countries who are secretly hoarding and laundering money with the help of British offshore banks. A hard Brexit or no-deal Brexit, on the other hand, would mean business as usual, and those anti-tax avoidance directives wouldn't affect the UK or its territories. This is the plain and simple reason why so many of the most powerful supporters of Brexit, who are wealthy business tycoons, who also happen to be named in the Paradise Papers, suddenly began proclaiming that Britain had to leave the EU, the sooner and harder the better. As soon as the EU's tax avoidance proposal was announced, they set about portraying the EU as the great enemy of Britain, an undemocratic elite causing misery for ordinary Brits. Sadly, though, the methods we've already explained, many ordinary British citizens believed that they were sold. But then, things didn't quite work out as planned. After she became Prime Minister, Theresa May spent a long time with other EU national leaders working out and agreeing a pragmatic Brexit plan. Remember that Theresa May was originally a Remainer. But when this huge withdrawal agreement finally came out, some of the most prominent Leave voters were deeply unhappy with it. Why? Well, because at the back of the document, there was a commitment by the British government to retain the EU's new anti-tax avoidance laws. Suddenly, the British Prime Minister was being branded as a traitor and was undermined by her own party, many of which are also wealthy elite businessmen. It's worth noting here that the recent deal that was agreed by Boris Johnson, which many of the news providers are quoting as saying that it's 95% the same as Theresa May's deal. Well, that 5%, the differing pieces, as well as the removal of the backstop, which they are discussing, what they don't say is that they've removed the parts in regard to the tax avoidance directives also. But another Prime Minister, if one could be found, preferably an unprincipled opportunist who will say and do absolutely anything to get into 10 Downing Street, perhaps he could convince the people of Britain that it would be best to just ignore Theresa May's deal and then simply wait for Britain to crash out of the EU with no deal whatsoever, And then, literally overnight, there will be no new corporate tax laws for the tax avoiders to worry about. Better still, with the right Prime Minister at the helm, the UK itself could be transformed into a Singapore-style tax haven for the wealthy, and this option is now being actively pursued by Boris Johnson's government. But now, Brexit offers so much more than just support for tax avoidance. Market fundamentalism. So you'll remember the global recession of 2008. How can you forget? Many experts blamed the financial crisis on the United States and UK government's constant and consistent failure to regulate the increasingly reckless behaviour of their banking and financial sectors. To help protect Europe from the risk of such actions leading to another recession, the EU focused on tightening regulations. But then came the 2016 EU referendum result and the prospect of the UK actually leaving the EU. For some in the UK, this suddenly opened up a whole new vista of possibilities. Free market ideologists believe that market forces and the profit motive are inherently good, while any kind of government regulation or public spending is inherently bad. So immediately after the referendum result, the free market think tank, the Centre for Policy Studies, CPS, announced on the 26th of June 2016, "The weakness of the Labour Party and the resolution of the EU question have created a unique political opportunity to drive through a wide-ranging revolution on a scale similar to that of the 1980s. This must include removing unnecessary regulatory burdens on businesses, such as those related to climate directives and investment funds." So the vacuum of regulations that would be created by Brexit suddenly presented an opportunity to reshape the entire British economy, minimising the public sector and giving complete rein to the private sector. This is another reason why some very powerful billionaires have been sponsoring and championing Brexit as a means to deregulate UK business and especially London's financial centre, the City. The majority of money donated to Boris Johnson's campaign has come from hedge fund managers and other financiers backing Britain's exit from the European Union, favouring low taxes and the deregulation of the UK economy, said journalist Rob Merrick from The Independent on the 4th of July 2019. And indeed, Brexit now promises the private sector free rein by ditching EU regulations once and for all. And with city-friendly politicians now in government actively pursuing a no-deal Brexit, the UK won't be adopting any EU-like regulations anytime soon. Quite the opposite, in fact, as Britain begins kowtowing to US demands. So by selling the biggest set of lies ever passed off as truth to the British electorate in the history of the United Kingdom, the British elite and foreign governments, hell-bent on fracturing the UK for their own interests, have succeeded in their plan, whose primary goal is a financial strength, solidifying power, and a right-wing endgame. I wish I could say that at this point in the podcast we were speculating, but so far everything we have covered is based on hard evidence, facts and information readily available in the public domain, as I mentioned at the start. Now this is where things take a much darker turn. In her 2007 novel titled The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, Canadian author Naomi Klein argues that neoliberal free market policies have come to the forefront of prominence in developed Western countries. This is because of a specific strategy of shock therapy, which is utilized by the authorities in those countries. The theory lays out the explanation of a national crisis to force through controversial or unpopular policies, while the citizens of that nation are too emotionally and or physically distracted by the disasters or upheavals that they are facing to mount any kind of effective resistance, something they surely would do in a calmer climate. Klein's book suggests that some man-made events such as the Iraq War were purposefully undertaken with a definitive intention of pushing through unpopular policies in their wake, policies that benefit the few, the elite, and are highly likely not wanted by the electorate. I find the subject of disaster capitalism fascinating. The tactics used therein have no bounds and can be incredibly polarizing. In fact, the methods used within its strategies might be construed as savage and draconian, forcing through drastic, radical, and utterly extreme changes without the intervention or watching eye of democracy, or giving the many the voice that they are owed under the UK's constitution, for example. In fact, you could argue that under the methods of disaster capitalism, those rules, regulations, laws, and democratic obligations might be swept aside as a hindrance to usher in replacements not akin to methods of a dictatorship. An absolute toxic modus operandi, disaster capitalism was born out of an American economist by the name of Milton Friedman. His views and strategy for shock therapy in economics, or the sudden release of price and currency controls, withdrawals of state subsidies, and the immediate trade liberalization of a nation, including large-scale privatization of previously public-owned assets. An example of how this might look might be, I don't know, a post-Brexit UK being short on medicines with an increased mortality rate and panic among the electorate, leading to the immediate privatisation of the NHS to bring in emergency supplies and controls from United States-based Big Pharma, for example. This would be something the UK electorate would never vote for or allow under normal circumstances. But in a manufactured crisis, flooded with misinformation, a government of individuals with strong self-interests might usher this in under the guise of for the good of the people, while all the while profiting significantly from the NHS's sale and leaving the country in a much worse off situation, without the option of availability of reversal. Additionally, how might supply and demand appear in regards to food items when over half of all consumables in the UK are imported from the EU? Could food shortages lend to increased prices? Likely. Who could benefit from increased prices and control over imports? People do desperate things when they are hungry. People panic buy. Hell of an opportunity for false markups. Hell of an opportunity to force subpar goods on the people that were protected under EU law from such poor products. And what's more, the opportunity is there to charge them even more for a lesser product, such as supply and demand. Some of the leading Leave voters, who have claimed continually throughout the 3 years since Brexit that leaving the EU will lead to enormous dividends for the UK. Well, a large proportion of these people are, in fact, hedge fund investors seeking enormous dividends for their own self-interests, not for the greater country. They are capitalizing on the opportunity to make vast fortunes, millions if not billions of pounds, by managing their fortunes in the directions of chaos, uncertainty, and the inevitable pandemonium that a no-deal Brexit will deliver. Simply put, hedge fund managers are high-stakes investors who gamble on the economy. They place bets on an economic value that might rise or fall, such as like the value of sterling, for example. The world is a game of risk, and a humanitarian disaster or economic crisis is a fantastic opportunity to make a killing, so to speak. Many in the UK government, many of the top elites in the Conservative Party, many cabinet ministers invest in such hedge fund portfolios. They quite literally make millions upon millions in personal fortune from these hedge funds. The basic salary of a UK Member of Parliament is £79,000 per year. Where do you think their loyalties lie? The people or their self-interests? It really is basic economics. Let's take a look at Jacob Rees-Mogg, the current Conservative Party MP for North East Somerset, who is also the leader of the House of Commons and Lord President of the Council. Rees-Mogg is one of the strongest supporters of the United Kingdom leaving the EU. According to the Register of MPs' Interests, Rees-Mogg owns more than 15% of financial firm Somerset Capital. Although since becoming leader of the House of Commons this year, Rees-Mogg stepped down from day-to-day work at the firm, he still enjoys a 15% holding and significant dividend share. It's also not unreasonable to assume that he still holds significant influence at the firm that he co-funded, which is why it seems strange that over the last year the firm has moved significant wealth and assets to the Republic of Ireland, ensuring that they can still enjoy all the benefits that the EU brings even after the UK leaves the European Union. What does that tell us, if not protectionism of self-interest over knowledge of the oncoming economic disaster that his politics will bring? Also, William Rees-Mogg, Jacob's father, actually wrote a book championing the financial benefits of a social and economic collapse for a few wise and future-proof investors. The book lays out with technical clarity why Jacob not only wants Brexit, but also all the carnage that rides on the wind with it. According to William Rees-Mogg, all nations, governments, social services, and even democracy itself will eventually collapse. There will be no more supporting the poor and the sick, no benefits, no welfare state. It will be survival of the fittest, from the inevitable violence and panic that will erupt when the masses turn on each other. Only the most capable and self-interested investors will inherit what's left of the land. To quote John Harris from The Guardian on August 6, 2018, there is a reason why the hard Brexiteers cannot coherently explain their vision of Brexit. Their chief aim is to break as many things as possible, in the belief that from the rubble might arise a kind of flag-waving, small-state, free-market utopia that even the blessed Margaret Thatcher might not have found palatable. Shortages simply mean high demand. Shortages mean higher prices. Deregulation will mean giving the greedy greater freedom to exploit those in need. And what's more, the people have been fed so many Brexit lies, they are begging for this to happen. But why sit around waiting for an economic disaster to exploit when you can conveniently engineer one for yourself? One of the new EU directives that was designed to regulate the financial sector, that was known as the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive, laid down rules on the worst excesses of unscrupulous hedge funds. It addressed everything from their secrecy to how much managers could pay themselves in bonuses. The new directive brings transparency and security to the way these funds are managed and operate. Until this directive came into play in 2011, hedge fund managers in London had been used to operate in any way they liked, acting as recklessly as they liked, and all outside of the system. Well, as you can imagine, they took exception to this directive and began singing to the heavens that Britain had to leave the European Union. Such singing only increased further when in 2015 they were fined by the Greek government for interfering with the struggling Greek economy and contributed to the economic chaos there. They have supported Vote Leave, Boris Johnson, and a no-deal Brexit ever since. Go figure. So this last weekend, Boris Johnson and the European Union announced that they had finally reached a Brexit deal. It took 3.5 years of negotiations and still has to be approved by UK Parliament, but we can finally see what the outcome will look like if it gets approved purely on the design of Boris Johnson. In analysing the details that were released by the government, there are several elements that Boris Johnson and the Conservatives are not shouting from the rooftops, incidentally. The deal quietly paves the way for deregulation of industry. It also gives Johnson the free rein and also contains more than a hint of intention that the Conservatives plan to slash workers' rights, environmental standards and consumer protections, making specific decision to move their reference from the legal bill of the deal to a political promise document which isn't even worth the paper it's written on, given how the Conservatives have already sold out the DUP over the deal. Essentially, my earlier predictions, which I wrote several weeks ago, and the start of this podcast, are being confirmed. In preparing this episode, I made posts on social media asking for people who voted Leave to contact me to discuss the reasons for why they wish to leave the European Union. When several individuals got in touch with me, no one would give me the specific reasons for why they decided to vote Leave in the 2016 referendum. None of them would consent to a recorded interview with myself for broadcast on the podcast, and some even stated that given what they now know, they would change their vote and vote Remain if they could. What's certain is that one of the biggest tragedies of Brexit is the split that has torn the country apart. Heated, volatile and turbulent, the political climate in the United Kingdom might take more than a generation to heal, experts predict. In selling the lies of Brexit, the Vote Leave campaign has created a die-hard group of supporters who truly believe that leaving the European Union is the best thing for them and their future. They will support the Conservatives, Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, no matter what, but that after Britain leaves the EU, they will be abandoned as only the rich and wealthy will ever benefit from the plans of the Conservatives in power, the way it always has been. Meanwhile, millions will feel abandoned, without a voice, and hollow at the thought of our democratic system failing. Ask anyone to explain what a politician is, or define a member of parliament, and generally, somewhere in their answer you will get, they're all as bad as each other, you can't trust any of them, or all politicians lie, it's what they do. The bigger question really is, why do we allow and accept it? Follow our Instagram for podcast updates, news and daily features. You can find us at instagram.com/dead_souls_podcast. Take care of yourselves, everyone, and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.